And now that awkward moment when I have to acknowledge for the tape that the recording started a little late. So we just read source number one. But basically what Justice Brennan is arguing in source number one is something really important, that the sole reason that the city, the town of Allegheny, was celebrating Hanukkah to begin with was because they were celebrating Christmas at the same time. It is rare. You don't tend to see when you go into Target, you know, in the run-up to Rosh Hashanah or Sukkot, you don't see decorations for Rosh Hashanah or Sukkot. It's only when you go into Target in the run-up to Christmas do you see that they also have their gifts for Jews at the same time. So just as Brennan already makes a really compelling argument, which is something we have to consider, that the sole emphasis on Hanukkah actually already, not the sole emphasis, but the emphasis on Hanukkah in the secular world already points to a Christianization of Judaism. You know, we all probably like to some extent seeing all of these various Hanukkah songs appearing on YouTube, not Hanukkah songs by Jewish artists, but by non-Jewish artists who, you know, nowadays it's very normal. You throw a Hanukkah song on your Christmas album. But in a certain sense, that's just promoting, to quote Justice Brennan, a Christianized version of Judaism. Where's the Rosh Hashanah? You know, on the Christmas album, really what would be appropriate would be a rendition of Unatane Tokef to capture the central moment of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, not a song relevant to Hanukkah. If we continue looking at source number two, which is Sandra Day O'Connor, and she says the following, and she is countering, she is arguing against, she is what Justice Brennan is saying. She says, in setting up its holiday display, which included the lighted tree and the menorah, the city of Pittsburgh stressed the theme of liberty and pluralism by accompanying the exhibit with a sign bearing the following message. Quote, during this holiday season, the city of Pittsburgh salutes liberty. Let these festive lights remind us that we are the keepers of the flame of liberty and our legacy of freedom. This sign indicates that the city intended to convey its own distinctive message of pluralism and freedom. By accompanying its display of a Christmas tree, a secular symbol of the Christmas holiday season, with a salute to liberty, and by adding a religious symbol from a Jewish holiday also celebrated at roughly the same time of the year, I conclude that the city did not endorse Judaism or religion in general, but rather conveyed a message of pluralism and freedom of belief during the holiday season. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor and Justice Brennan aren't arguing the core point, just one sees it as a good thing and one sees it as a bad. Pittsburgh wanted to have a symbol of pluralism, and so it took symbols from both Jews and Christians. Fine. But Justice Brennan's point is, by taking the Jewish symbol and elevating it at a time of the year where, you know, Hanukkah, at the end of the day, is not a central festival, you are in many ways Christianizing Hanukkah. You are turning Hanukkah into Jewish Christmas by juxtaposing the menorah and the tree. And one more thing that he says relevant to this, source number three, the uncritical acceptance of a message of religious pluralism also ignores the extent to which even that message may offend. Many religious faiths are hostile to each other and indeed refuse even to participate in ecumenical services designed to demonstrate the very pluralism, Justices Blackmun and O'Connor extol. To lump the ritual objects and holidays of religions together without regard to their attitudes towards such inclusiveness, or to decide which religions should be excluded because of the possibility of offense, is not a benign or beneficent celebration of pluralism. It is instead an interference in religious matters precluded by the Establishment Clause. So thus far, sources 1 through 3 set us up with, I think, an interesting road to explore. That the elevation and the celebration of Hanukkah alongside Christmas in the secular sphere, in wider society, might actually be in some ways even more offensive than solely the celebration of Christmas. Because what it shows, if you walk into, again, you walk into Target and you see only Christmas things on display, your conclusion is, okay, this is not for me. I'm a Jew. I recognize that I'm a minority in this society, and I can make peace with the fact that they aren't catering to my celebration of Hanukkah. But by them catering to my celebration of Hanukkah, in a sense, What Justice Brennan is arguing here is in some ways it's even more offensive, because they're taking the festival they understand. They are taking the festival that we consider relatively minor in the grand scheme of things and elevating it because it aligns with their celebration of Christmas. There is one final thing I want to just draw your attention when it comes to the justices, because it's fascinating. It's not really relevant to what I want to talk about, but it's fascinating nonetheless. And which is that Justice Brennan actually did think that the menorah violated the Establishment Clause. He thought it was the government getting involved in religion and was bad. And he actually has, he points out, you know, it's an 18-foot menorah on government property. That's about as religious a symbol as you can get. And he also criticizes Justice Blackmun for only mentioning in a footnote that Chabad actually used this for services. He's like, it's a religious object used as part of a religious service. Nonetheless, he still sided that the menorah was allowed to stay up for other legal reasons. But I do just want to read for you, source number four is his kind of like, it's a very cynical comment, and personally, I'm the kind of person who enjoys reading, you know, people who write cynical comments when they're being snappy with one another. So I decided to put it in the source sheet. Source number four. I do not know how we can decide whether it was the tree that stripped the religious connotations from the menorah or the menorah that laid bare the religious origins of the tree. Both are reasonable interpretations of the scene the city presented, and thus both, I think, should satisfy Justice Blackmun's requirement, the display, quote, be judged according to the standard of a reasonable observer. And then this is my line that I love coming up. I shudder to think that the only reasonable observer is one who shares the particular views on perspective, spacing, and accent expressed in Justice Blackmun's opinion, thus making analysis under the Establishment Clause look more like an exam in Art 101 than an inquiry into constitutional law. So I just like that source, because he's clearly, you can feel the fury with which he is writing it. But to turn back to the topic I actually want to discuss is to take what Justice Brennan and Sandra Day O'Connor are debating and flip it slightly as more relevant to us. They are arguing that wider society has almost Christianized Hanukkah. The flip question for us is that what we are doing? What is leading to our excitement during Hanukkah, the celebration, our enthusiasm for celebrating Hanukkah? Is it what we might call, and again, I'm kind of putting two very extreme positions here, but like a genuine, it's a religious holiday, boom, we're going to celebrate it, we're Jews? Or is it, we have our own winter holiday to celebrate? And so what I want to begin with exploring this question is the one most obvious and explicit way in which Hanukkah has become Jewish Christmas, which is basically undeniable, and that is the act of gift giving. And while there have been some prominent rabbis in the recent past who have tried to argue that Christians actually took the gift giving from us, that it's a practice that's actually original to Hanukkah and was taken by the Christians, you have to basically believe in counterfactual history to accept such an approach. The truth is that gift giving is very much something we have borrowed. And what's worth just looking at, because it's a very, very powerful idea, is what Jews used to do far more, and there are many sources pointing to Jews doing this, which was the act of giving gelt, of giving money to one another on Hanukkah. And I've had some other fora where I've kind of shared this idea before, but I've never actually pointed to the explicit sources. And I just want to take a look. It's actually a very important idea. So if you take a look at source number five, we read this last week and we focused on the first half. This time around, it's actually the second half of Rambam's statements that are more relevant to us. And source number five, Rambam says the following, Mitzvat ner Chanukah mitzvah chavivahi ad ma'ad. And it's an exceedingly precious mitzvah to light your Chanukah lamp. Vitzarich adam lihizahaba. You have to be very, very particular in observing it. Kedei lahodia hanes, to appreciate the miracle. Olahosif b'shevach ho'el v'hodaya lo al hanisim she'asalenu, and to express your appropriate levels of thanksgiving to God for the miracles he performed for us. Afilu ein lo ma yochal, if you have nothing to eat, ela min hatstaka, you're living off charity. Shoel, you have to beg, you have to ask. Umolcha ksuta, or sell literally the clothes off your back. V'lokeach shemen v'neirot umadlik, to buy lamps in order to be able to light neirot Chanukah. Rambam is very explicit that you have to be able to afford the ability to light your menorah at all costs. You can imagine that this is a tremendous problem for poor people. It's actually a very, very difficult. Thank God all of us, none of us are in such a state of poverty that we can't go out now and buy a pack of candles and just light one a night in order to fulfill our obligation. But there were times when this wasn't the case, and I forgot to put on the source sheet, and the Magen Avraham, Rabbi Avraham Gombiner, who's a prominent Polish rabbi, who points out that one of the customs, one of the practices on Hanukkah night was that the children would knock on the doors begging for money in order to pay for Neirot Hanukkah. But there is a beautiful, beautiful halachic perspective recorded in another area of halacha that potentially has relevance. Source number 6, I'll read it in a second, is from the laws of Avelut, from the laws of mourning. And there is a practice, and the truth is nowadays we actually do this practice at some degree, of providing meals for those who are in mourning. And we might think, oh, the reason we provide meals for those in mourning, it's a show of support, it's difficult. The last thing you need to be doing is worrying about feeding yourself and your family, so we provide them for meals. But there's actually a far more powerful explanation behind this practice, and it is quoted by in the work known as the Be'er HaGola. It's written by a rabbi who died in the 1670s, but he is quoting Rabbeinu Yerucham, who was one of the most prominent early authorities, one of the most prominent Rishonim, 14th century Provence. And he writes, and source number 6 says the following. Katav Rabbeinu Yerucham. So he quotes Rabbeinu Yerucham. Shenahagu le'echol mishal acherim kol shiva. That the practice is that, the mourner is given meals by everyone else, by other people, the entire week of shiva. Mipnei aniye Yisrael. She'enam yecholim la'asot melacha. Because poor people, during shiva, they can't go out to work. And if they're living paycheck to paycheck, if they literally have to earn the money with which to make food, with which to buy food, well, now they're not making their income. They don't have anything else. And therefore, these poor people sitting shiva will not be able to feed themselves and their family. And so Rabbeinu Yerucham says there is a practice that the whole community rallies round to make sure that those who can't afford to provide for meals during shiva for themselves, it's all taken care of. However, then Rabbeinu Yerucham continues, V'lo yidbaishu sha'af la'ashirim osin kein. But we don't want to embarrass these poor people. They're already in mourning. And now we're literally telegraphing to the entire community, so-and-so is so poor, they can't afford to put food on the table, everyone lets a rally round. So instead, in order to not embarrass them, we have a communal practice where everyone always gets meals during shiva, whether they need it, whether they don't, so that no one ever needs to feel like a beggar. It's a very powerful idea. Really speaks to the notion of Jewish community rallying around those in need in a very sensitive way. But many point to essentially source number 6 as the answer to source number 5 and the explanation of the custom of giving money to others on Hanukkah. What do you do on Hanukkah? You are poor. So says Rambam, you basically have to beg. That's embarrassing. That's demeaning. You have to sell the clothes off your back. That's horrific to make someone do that. So instead, give people money. Just go out already and give everyone, $50 so that they have enough money to fulfill their obligation on Neirat Chanukah. You don't want to give it to just the poor people because then you're creating charity cases and that's insensitive. So instead, we have this practice of giving money to everyone on Hanukkah, in order to ensure that those who need it have it. It's a very beautiful idea. It's a very powerful notion on Hanukkah to think about. But what it has morphed into, undeniably, is let's give everyone presents because it's Christmas and all the toys are being advertised, and that's what they expect. And so, in some ways, you know, something has slightly been lost. I do know, we are not one of these families that does, but I do know there are some families who basically, you know, they always, rather than one night giving their child a present, the present is kind of donated to a one of these organizations, that sort of thing. Maybe we'll do that this year if we want our children to cry one night for some reason. But broadly speaking, one way which is goes without saying, Hanukkah has been taken over by Christmas, is in what for many of us is one of its central features, gift giving. It's not Jewish. Let's just be honest with ourselves. Let's not pretend otherwise, but fine. The question then becomes, what about other aspects of our celebration of Hanukkah? And so here is where we move. There are still a couple more sources, but here is where we move away from, you know, sources per se and more into the thoughts, because there are a few ways that I was thinking about how to analyze this question of, do we treat Hanukkah just as Jewish Christmas? And so there are a few questions, I think, that need to be answered, a few ideas that need to be considered in order to help better answer, you know, this question for all of us. The first of which is the question of consistency. Did you approach Hanukkah? Do we all approach Hanukkah with the same level of excitement as all the other Chagim or not? So how excited were we? How much preparation were we, did we put into Rosh Hashanah? Will we put into Pesach? How much do we, I mean, Pesach forces us to rearrange our homes, but how much effort are we putting into our preparation for Hanukkah versus the rest of the Chagim? If we basically put, reasonably speaking, the same amount of effort, then we are not falling prey to the Christianization of Hanukkah. But if we treat Hanukkah as uniquely special, despite the fact that it's a rabbinic holiday, if we treat Hanukkah as uniquely special, then we might have fallen prey to, you know, wider society's own influence upon us. And, you know, just to kind of use personal example here, you know, I did, full confession, I went to Target a couple of weeks ago now, and I basically bought out 85% of their, we'll come back to the other 15 that they didn't touch soon. I basically bought 85% of their Hanukkah stuff, like each one of the items, I basically bought it all. I love it. I, you know, stuck it all around the house, all those various things. But the truth be told, if I walked into Target in the run-up to Pesach and they had Seder stuff, I would do the same thing. And I know I do the same thing because in previous, you know, years, I've lived in communities which have larger, you know, kind of, you know, they have Jewish supermarkets and the Jewish supermarkets have all their Pesach stuff and all their cute themed, you know, Pesach things you can buy. And I go out and I buy it every single year. And for Sukkot, I'd go crazy if I could. So the fact that this year I went and I bought, you know, the sticky, you know, the kids love those things you stick on the glass, you know, the dreidel, the menorahs, the this and that. But if they made a shofar, we would have had that on our front door. And that right now, if you go past our front door, we have like a little sign that's basically counting the days of Hanukkah. It's very cute. But if they made one for the days of Sukkot, if Target made that, I would have bought it. No one else would, which is why they don't sell it. But if they made it, I would have bought it. So I think the first major question we have to ask is, do we treat Hanukkah with the same level of enthusiasm for the other Chagim, or it's the flip version of the question. Are we as enthusiastic for the other Chagim as we are for Hanukkah? Or are we uniquely excited about Hanukkah because it's this time of year? Now, it should be noted already, and this is where complications... There's no black and white here, I should just stress. Because there is another reason why Hanukkah is... You might be more excited for Hanukkah than Sukkot. And it's a source I didn't put on the source sheet this time around, but we've seen it for the past 2 weeks, where Rashi emphasizes there is no Isur Melacha. There is no prohibition. There are no prohibited activities on Hanukkah. And Yair was just asking this last night, I think it was. He was asking, like, you know, all the other Yamim Tovim, we have days that are like Shabbat. But are there any days like that on Hanukkah? And Ruthie and I, it took us a while to figure out what he was asking. But we realized he was basically asking, like, think about it, Sukkot and Pesach. You have Yom Tov and you have Chol HaMoed. On the Yamim Tovim, you can't do, you do differently fun things, but you don't have the same, you know, Hanukkah together with Purim. They have that nice kind of, you just kind of stay with your regular, you know, week, and you infuse it with the celebration of Hanukkah, as opposed to the total upheaval. So admittedly, someone might look forward to Hanukkah more than Sukkot, because they didn't have to cook 16 meals in advance in order to be on top of things ready for, you know, Sukkot. Hanukkah, it's just a regular day. But broadly speaking, nonetheless, if our enthusiasm comes from the external societal force of celebrating a winter holiday, that's very different to we like the Chagim and Hanukkah happens to be particularly fun. I did just refer, I should just note, because I am a pedant, I did just group Hanukkah in among the other Chagim. And there are people who are hyper pedantic who will point out that there is no more inappropriate greeting to wish someone on Hanukkah than Chag Sameach, because a Chag technically refers to a day on which the Korban Chagiga, the special Chagiga sacrifice, was brought, and that was only brought on biblical festivals. And Hanukkah and Purim, there are no special sacrificial offerings for Hanukkah and Purim, and therefore there was no Chagiga. Hanukkah is not a Chag. And to say Chag Sameach to someone is to, you know, reveal your own ignorance. I am a pedant, so I like pointing that out to people, but I am not so much of a pedant that I am offended if someone wishes me Chag Sameach. But there was a moment today, I walked into drop of shy at the CDC, the J's, you know, childcare preschool thing that they have. And they have a nice little fact sheet about, you know, what to say on Hanukkah. And they said, like, you know, wish people Chag Sameach. And I stopped myself from correcting them because I realized that would be an unproductive endeavor, but I was tempted to, but then I stopped myself. But anyway, that's me getting slightly caught up with pedanticisms. But the first question that we have to ask ourselves is the one of consistency. The second question, and I actually think is a far more important one because it has halachic weight, is the concept of the prohibition of chukat hagoyim. The Torah says in Sefer Vayikra, the following source number 7. Kema'aseh eretz Mitzrayim asher yishavtem ba lo ta'asu. Do not copy any of the practices of the land of Egypt where you lived. Uchma'aseh eretz Kana'an, and the practices of the land of Kana'an. Asher ani mevi etchem shama lo ta'asu. Don't copy anything that they do when you get there. Uvuchukoteche, uvuchukotehem lo telechu, nor shall you follow their laws. Uvuchukotehem lo telechu. This is a biblical prohibition to follow the laws of non-Jewish nations. What exactly does this mean? What is the prohibition of chukat hagoyim? So there are two broad categories. It is obviously, as you can imagine, an incredibly complicated area of halacha to digest. And I don't want to get too caught up in the weeds, but there are two distinct areas where it's worth talking about. The first is the blatantly obvious copying religious practices. So to buy a Christmas tree and put one up in your home is a pretty much textbook obvious violation of chukat hagoy. There is a more interesting category, which I think is where things get, well, interesting, which is copying the practices of non-Jewish nations that aren't necessarily religious or cultural in nature per se, but you are doing it to be like them. It's a tightrope halacha, because you can imagine by that definition how easily you could include some things versus others. But I actually think this comes up practically speaking when it comes to buying the Hanukkah stuff in Target, because the other 15% the stuff I didn't buy kind of falls into one of two categories. The reason I didn't buy it was, you know, one thing I really wanted to buy, Target sells a dinosaur menorah and a dog menorah. So I was thinking, you know, Yair is 6, Shai is 3. Oh, wonderful. The problem was that after a brief inspection, I realized that neither the dinosaur nor the dog would be halachically valid. You know, they wouldn't conform to the various laws that the menorah needs to conform to in order to be halachically valid. And I was like, it's not worth getting the kids excited by this dinosaur menorah, because even though both of them are young enough that it's not really a problem right now, I don't want them to have this attachment to a non-kosher menorah. Fine. The other objects I didn't buy were those things that struck me as Christmas versions, Hanukkah versions of Christmas decorations. So we have, you know, the Hanukkah sign. We have the, you know, Magen David silicone placemat for under your menorah. We have the, you know, which is just safety. We have the, you know, the sticky things. Personally, I draw the line at blue tinsel. Because, to my mind, the only reason you would want to buy tinsel is because it's tinsel season. And everyone else has green and red tinsel. Admittedly, I should at this point in full confession, I like buying the colored menorah, the colored oils to light my menorah. And I won't lie, in previous years, I've sometimes got a kick out of doing a red green theme at certain times. But it's also because they give you red, green, blue, and yellow, and so at some point you're kind of forced into it. But you know, you see the red and the green tinsel, and you want your blue tinsel instead. And that, for me, kind of crosses that tightrope, falls off that tightrope of v'chukotehem lo teilechu, of kind of observing the practices. It, for me, that is slightly too much Jewish Christmas. And I do have a Hanukkah sweater that I bought. For me, that's kind of the dividing line. The Hanukkah sweater is still good because it's Hanukkah themed and I like to be comfy and warm. And yes, I will be changing into it straight after this year. But I think that's another important consideration. Are we bringing in these things into our home? Are we getting excited by Hanukkah and all these various things we can buy? Or are we trying to recreate someone else's festival in our own language? And that, I think, is a really important consideration to ask oneself. That being said, I think there is another value also, and it's Jewish pride. Because the truth is that, again, blue tinsel might be too far, but there is something to inculcating within ourselves, and especially if there are, you know, young children in a home or whatnot, creating this sense of excitement around Hanukkah, I think, is something that's really positive. The fact that nowadays they don't really do Christmas episodes of kids' TV shows. They do seasonal episodes of TV shows. So, you know, Yair will watch a TV show and that one of the characters turns out to be Jewish. It might just be a passing scene, you know, one like he's watching, you know, TV show X and, you know, it's a Christmas episode. But like all of a sudden they cut in a montage to one of the side characters who, instead of, you know, having a Christmas tree, is lighting a menorah. And it's like, oh, for Yair, it's like, this is the Jewish character. It's like, I don't know how many people here have ever read Harry Potter, but in the 4th Harry Potter book, you learn that there is a kid called Anthony Goldstein in Ravenclaw. And it's like, oh, he's the Jewish kid. Oh, great. Like, no, everyone else in the history of reading Harry Potter has never noticed Anthony Goldstein. Just like I read Harry Potter books and that there are characters with Indian names or other, you know, ethnicity names, just goes like, goes, you know, in one ear and out the other. But the Jewish name, I fixate on. So there is a value to inculcating a sense of Jewish pride. At the end of the day, Hanukkah is all about Pirsumei Nisa, publicizing the miracle. Right now, if you found yourself on my block, you could still see, you know, the last vestiges of my menorah lit. And you'll see, you know, and it's beautiful, actually. You know, I live on our block with several members of BIAV. So it's nice to actually look out of my window and see, like, lots of, you know, explicit, visible Hanukkah observances taking place just outside the door. There's something so beautiful about that pride. And the truth is, that when the Amazon delivery guy, you know, came earlier today to drop off the forbidden gifts that should never have been bought, but nonetheless were. But there were no menorot burning at that time because it was during the day, but he still saw the Hanukkah sign on the front door. So he would have known, you know, if he wouldn't have spotted the mezuzah, he would have known, this is the Jewish family. They are celebrating Hanukkah. And so I think there is no, I wouldn't go as far as to say to use the halachic term kiyum. There is no fulfillment of Pirsume Nisa by having my sticky dreidel on the window. I'm not going that far. But there is something to, you know, the next door neighbors are so, you know, extreme in their celebration of their holiday that we do something too. And so I think all of these forces somewhat counterbalance one another. It kind of goes back to source number four and Justice Brennan's point. You can't really draw very clear lines under any of this stuff, but nonetheless, it's a guiding question. And so there are three guiding questions I would say we need to ask whenever we come up to Hanukkah to avoid the celebration of Jewish Christmas as opposed to the celebration of Hanukkah. The first is the question of consistency. Are we celebrating Hanukkah with the same verve that we celebrate other festivals? The second question is, are we making sure to try and avoid violating the prohibition of copying the other nations? If our celebration of Hanukkah, even if we are as enthusiastic about Hanukkah as we are about Sukkot, it is all too easy to accidentally slip down that slope and unintentionally start celebrating kind of the wrong festival. But that being said, we want to inculcate a sense of Jewish pride. And we want ourselves and our family members to share that excitement and that pride that we are Jews and we celebrate our own festival and we are happy for the whole world to know. There is one final, very important consideration. And that is that as much as we want to have a sense of Jewish pride, of all the festivals, it is Hanukkah that is the festival that symbolizes our resistance to cultural assimilation. And it's very fascinating because, again, the grand irony of Hanukkah is that because of its proximity to Christmas, it has been embraced. It is so much more embraced. You know, Ruthie sent me a clip of Stephen Colbert, had a whole thing about Hanukkah last night, which was funny. But like Hanukkah is embraced by the non-Jewish world, by the wider Jewish world, far more than many other festivals, despite the fact that its story is a rejection of cultural assimilation. And I don't want to unpack that right now, but there is a lot to unpack in the story of Hanukkah and what it means to be, you know, a Jew in the modern world in the 21st century. But at the end of the day, we are celebrating a festival that is all about resisting cultural assimilation, maintaining a certain level of separateness and distinctiveness. And so with that in mind, source number eight is a line from Rav Soloveitchik, a quote from Rav Soloveitchik, who had an admittedly very extreme view on all things interfaith. But it's an important line to understand nonetheless. And it dovetails nicely with Justice Brennan's point that Jews might not appreciate Hanukkah being celebrated as Jewish Christmas. Rav Soloveitchik writes the following in source number eight. We are therefore opposed to any public debate, dialogue, or symposium concerning the doctrinal, dogmatic, or ritual aspects of our faith vis-a-vis similar aspects of another faith community. We believe in and are committed to our Maker in a specific manner, and we will not question, defend, offer apologies, analyze, or rationalize our faith in dialogues centered about these private topics, which express our personal relationship to the God of Israel. When, however, we move from the private world of faith to the public world of humanitarian and cultural endeavors, communication along the various faith communities is desirable and even essential. We are ready to enter into dialogue on such topics as war and peace, poverty, freedom, man's moral values, the threat of secularism, technology and human values, civil rights, etc. Rav Soloveitchik was very extreme, but very clear in his view. The interfaith dialogue should never be waded into. And as I stop the screen share, again, I don't want to turn this into a discussion on Rav Soloveitchik's view of interfaith dialogue, but it underscores what I think is the tension at the heart of our celebration of Hanukkah. In some ways, we are, of all the festivals, Hanukkah is the festival where we essentially declare, we do what we do. We pick no bones with what you do, just, as long as you don't make us, as long as you don't force us to do it either. We are good with what you do. We do what we do, kind of leave us alone. You know, we'll leave you alone and the rest be good. That is, in a nutshell, a core message of the Jewish experience of Jewish history. And it's a major idea within Hanukkah, like, allow me to let my menorah be visibly lit. I will take pride in my celebration of my Judaism, but I'm not inviting anyone else in. This is not, you know, this is not something for other people to join in with. This is what I am doing as part of my religion, and you know, you do you, and that is all fine. And the danger we run into is the not just the Christianization of Hanukkah, but, and this goes back to almost what I said in the first week about the question of my Hanukkah, what are we actually celebrating, is there becomes sometimes an infantilization of the celebration of Hanukkah in the public sphere that is, could be problematic. I was not in any way, you know, bothered or upset. Why would I be? By, you know, Stephen Colbert's skit. Basically, if you didn't see it yet, his basic point was like, you know, there's going to be 140 new Christmas movies released in this coming, you know, seasonal period by Hallmark and all these other channels. So he had a whole thing of like, what would, you know, there needs to be more Hanukkah movies. So we had these hilarious, you know, trailers for Hanukkah movies. It was funny, but there is a certain element of no. Like, don't try and take my festival and put it into the language of yours, because that's not what we do. That's not how these things work. That's not what Hanukkah is. Hanukkah is its own thing. It happens. It happens to fall, you know, around the same time as Christmas. This year it was closer to Thanksgiving, but, you know, it happens to be a winter, during the winter. But who cares? It's got nothing to do with the other. And so I think the central challenge we face is ensuring that we make sure, as much as we want to celebrate Hanukkah enthusiastically, as much as we want to instill a sense of pride and excitement at a time when often we feel most alienated from wider society, it's sure, it's nice to celebrate Hanukkah. But at the same time, we want to make sure that our desire to celebrate this festival is not fueled by an attempt to be like everyone else around us, but instead an opportunity to celebrate, you know, the miracles that we are appreciating God, that we are thanking God for, and that is our motivation for everything.